Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Shlohm. When Isaac Newton wrote his incredible treatise, Principia Mathematica, it laid down the laws of motion, optics, and more. It was a watershed moment in the history of science. But back in the 17th century, there was really no such thing as science or scientists. Instead, people like Newton were studying what was known then as natural philosophy. Philosophy and the drive to understand the hidden workings of nature have always had an interesting interwoven relationship, and now that relationship is being enhanced by people who study both philosophy and physics. Our guest is one of those folks. Chip Siebens is a professor of philosophy at the California Institute of Technology. He studies and teaches courses on how philosophical thought can help us understand some of the deepest mysteries in the realms of modern particle physics. While we use quantum theory to power our modern technology-based world, most of us have no idea how the tiny realms of subatomic particles are harnessed to run our laptops, tablets, and phones. It's a strange world, and one definitely worth exploring with someone like Chip Siebens. He joins us now from the Caltech campus in Pasadena, California. Chip Siebens, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I'm very interested in this interesting juxtaposition, this combination of philosophy and physics. It might sound to folks like it's a new thing, but it's actually quite ancient, going back to the ancient Greeks and Democritus and people like that. But I'm curious, what got you interested early on in studying philosophy and then physics? Which came first, you know, kind of the chicken and the egg question there?
I think in a way I was always interested in both. I was the kind of kid who liked to ponder the big questions, philosophical questions about the meaning of life, morality, that kind of thing. And maybe questions are more part of physics, like what's everything made of? What happened at the beginning of the universe? So I like those big questions. But when do you encounter those things in school, physics and philosophy? Usually you get physics first. Physics comes in high school and philosophy not until college. So I had my first physics class in high school, and it really resonated with me in terms of the way that my brain works. It was nice that you didn't have to memorize a bunch of facts. There were just a few basic principles, like F equals MA, and from those principles, you could get so much. So that was really exciting to me and interesting to me to see that you had this picture of nature that hangs together so tightly with a few principles and a lot that you can get from them. So it was a good fit for my skills and interests. And then what really got me excited about physics and made me want to do more and become a physicist was seeing all the open questions in physics. So I was reading, you know, popular science books about physics and the PBS series, The Elegant Universe, Brian Greene series.
Oh, that's so cool. It's funny you mentioned that. I was thinking about that today prior to your interview, looking back at the time when I was teaching physics in high school, not that long ago. And I loved to show that to my students, and they seem to enjoy it.
Yeah, that worked for me. And it came out while I was in high school, so the timing was perfect. And to me, that was like, okay, I want to go do that. I want to come up with theories of nature. I want to propose new laws. I want to see what works. And so I went to MIT to study physics and, you know, to invent theories of nature. And as I took these physics classes at MIT, they were great. But as the classes got deeper and deeper, in many ways, they seemed to veer off from the fundamental foundational questions that I was interested in. So particularly with quantum mechanics, you know, quantum mechanics is notoriously weird. And when you're first introduced to it, you think this is strange. What is this wave function? What is this theory really about? And the physics classes didn't spend too long on those oddities and just taught you how to use the equations. But I took a philosophy of quantum mechanics class with Brad Scow, and that felt to me like it was asking the right questions about quantum physics, asking these foundational questions. What is the theory really about? What are the laws of nature according to the theory? What is this thing called a wave function? Does it really collapse? Are there particles in addition to wave? What's going on here? And so seeing that you could pursue it within philosophy instead of physics intrigued me. And it took me a while to come around to it, but I ultimately decided that that was the path for me. And it's been wonderful.
Are there many people like you in your field that study philosophy and physics? I know of one other, but I can't think of her name off the top of my head. But I've heard of this a bit. But is there, you know, kind of a field of physics philosophy people like you?
Yeah, there's definitely a field of philosophy of physics. There's a few hundred people doing it around the world. You can look at the academic journal Philosophy of Physics as an example, and there's a Philosophy of Physics Society associated with that. I was just at a conference in Poland on foundations of physics. It had a lot of philosophers there, but there were also physicists and mathematicians all coming together to ask these foundational questions. Philosophy of physics, you know, borders on a number of fields, but there are, you know, people in physics doing foundations of physics who are doing work that is quite close to what philosophers doing philosophy of physics are doing.
Very interesting. And when this is all over, we'll meet at the Quantum Cafe.
Yeah, sounds good.
For you can order an orange, but we, you know, you might get a blue.
Yeah, this is from the Elegant Universe, right?
That's exactly right. Okay, yeah. So we'll get more into those topics in a bit, because quantum mechanics is something I definitely want to talk to you about. But before we do, let's talk about, you know, regular physics, like the stuff you studied in high school. You know, most of it is classical physics, you know, Newtonian physics. You mentioned F equals ma, the three laws of motion, you know, that the law of inertia, that, you know, body at rest stays at rest until an outside force acts upon it, or if it's in motion, it will continue in that motion without accelerating unless a force acts upon it, an unbalanced outside force. And then, of course, force equals mass times acceleration, F equals ma, the second law, which is just the most wonderful equation. It just opens up, like you said, once you just know that simple relationship, it opens up this wonderful myriad of possibilities to solve problems. And then the very misunderstood, usually, third law, which people equate as, for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. It's not quite like that. Explain to me, if you were explaining to, I don't know, a smart sixth grader like me, what does the third law actually say?
So the third law says that when one body impresses a force upon another, that force is going to have a certain magnitude. There's an amount of force and there's a direction to that force. So when one body exerts a force like that on another, then that other body exerts an equal and opposite force back on the original body.
Well said. You must have got an A in physics.
Yeah, maybe that's too much of the dictionary definition.
That's very good.
More intuitive. But.
Well, when we going back to Newton, when he published his famous Principia, you know, which was had all this incredible, you know, the laws of motion, stuff about optics and light, just incredible work. Many consider it, you know, maybe the second greatest piece of literature other than the Bible, because it really did change the world, caused the scientific revolution, which led to the Industrial Revolution. But back in the day, back then, there was no such word as science. It was natural philosophy. And so those people who were studying nature were called natural philosophers. I think that's kind of cool and resonates, you know, with what you do.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's nice to think that in the past you didn't have the philosophers in one building and the physicists in another working separately in separate departments, but that many individuals were asking all sorts of questions that might now be categorized as part of philosophy, questions that might now be categorized as part of physics. I think that's a really neat way to do things. So I would like to see the fields more closely connected in the way they used to be. They've diverged pretty far apart now. But there are people like me and others who are working at the border still. And there are good questions to be asked there.
Well, classical science, mechanics, you know, physics kind of plods along until, you know, around the time of the turn of the 20th century, around 1900, late 1800s, 1900. And then, you know, you get this guy named Einstein who comes up with the special and general theory of relativity, the photoelectric effect. And at the same time, you have these people, the Curies, Niels Bohr, lots of people like that, exploring the small scale inner workings of the atom and finding out about atomic structure. That's always been a fascinating thing to me, to think about these two interesting parts of physics kind of going through these revolutions at about the same time. You ever kind of think about that?
Yeah, yeah. What a time to be a physicist, huh? There was certainly a lot of exciting work to be done then, and they made a lot of progress. Yeah, I don't know if I have an explanation for the timing there as to why these steps forward were happening at the same time.
You know, perhaps, you know, just thinking as a philosopher a bit here, that, you know, you just have this confluence of these revolutionary thoughts going on through society and with and with scientists that, you know, lead to these just remarkable breakthroughs and changes.
Yeah, maybe in a way, these are both theories that could only be developed after classical electromagnetism reached the state of, you know, being understood pretty well. So you had Maxwell's theory of electromagnetism as this massive step forward in physics, as this wonderful, coherent, impressive theory. And then that leads to a bunch of questions.
Could you kind of explain that a bit in a nutshell, just to give us just a little bit of a basic understanding for those people who haven't had, you know, college physics courses? You know, explain what you mean by, you know, electromagnetic theory.
Sure. So we know principles like charges repel one another. So if you have two positively charged bodies, they push each other apart. Two bodies that have opposite charges attract each other. That's electric attraction and repulsion. There are magnetic interactions, like when you put two magnets near each other and they pull closer together. Or if you orient the magnets the right way, they'll push each other apart. So we have these forces of attraction and repulsion and other kinds of interactions between charged bodies and between magnets. Faraday and Maxwell and others studied those forces and came up with a general theory of how charged bodies and how magnets interact with one another. And that's Maxwell's theory of electromagnetism. And at its bottom, it's just a few equations. It's the four Maxwell equations. It's what's called the Lorentz force law. So a few basic principles, and you have this amazingly successful theory. And that theory led to Einstein's special theory of relativity. That paper that Einstein first wrote in 1905 on the special theory of relativity is called On the Electrodynamics of Moving Bodies. So what he was doing was studying electromagnetism and seeing that within this theory, there were the seeds of the special theory of relativity. So when you study how those interactions between charged bodies and magnets look from different frames of reference, how they look to moving observers, yeah, that's how Einstein got to the special theory of relativity. So relativity, in a way, came from electromagnetism, and also some of the early work in quantum mechanics is connected to electromagnetic forces.
And the special theory of relativity is like so many things in physics. When on first look, it seems counterintuitive. You know, there are many things in physics that are counterintuitive. Once you understand them, they become intuitive. But, you know, the fact that in special relativity, we had always thought of time as just ticking along at this rate, as if there was some master clock in the universe with this universal time. And then Einstein said, well, no, that's not how it works. It depends on your motion relative to another person keeping time. And I always thought that was just the most remarkable and fascinating thing, even as a kid.
Yeah. It's super interesting.
And when you talk about electromagnetic theory, that's a unifying of electricity and magnetism, two things that might seem to be different, but as we now know, are not. They're like a coin. You got heads and tails, magnetism on one side and electricity on the other. And then there's been, you know, ever since the time of Einstein and Niels Bohr and people like that, the desire to unify quantum mechanics and general relativity, which is his grand theory of gravity, really, and how space and time work in, you know, gravity fields. It's really always interested me that this desire to unify these two worlds, and we're still not there yet, are we?
No, we're not all the way there, but certainly fascinating to me as well. And when I was talking about my earlier interests in the philosophy of physics and how I came to study it, you know, those questions about trying to unify gravity and quantum physics were certainly motivating to me, made me want to study physics and try to push it forward. The way that my research has gone, I don't work directly on quantum theories of gravity now, but I see a lot of what I do as warm-up exercises to that, in a way, as ground clearing or setting the stage for quantum theories of gravity. What you're trying to unify in a quantum theory of gravity is general relativity and quantum physics. Quantum physics is as I was saying before, notoriously strange, and there are debates about how it should be understood. So I think making progress on cleaning up quantum physics or finding different ways to formulate or understand quantum physics could be super helpful for developing a good quantum theory of gravity. On the other side, you know, we can do some rethinking of general relativity and our understanding of gravity. So, you know, general relativity is often explained in terms of space-time curvature. So that's very different than other kinds of forces and interactions in nature. So when it comes to electromagnetism, like we were discussing before, we think of electric interactions, magnetic interactions, as mediated by fields. So if you have a positively charged body, it has this electric field around it pointing away from it. If you put another positively charged body in that electric field, it's going to experience a force away from the original positively charged body. So we model electric and magnetic interactions as mediated by these fields. But thinking of gravity as space-time curvature is something totally different. That's not modeling it as a field, at least it doesn't seem to be. What's been intriguing to me is studying approaches to general relativity where you think of gravity as more like the other forces and interactions, where you think of gravity as a field still, not actually a space-time curvature. So there are sort of heterodox approaches to general relativity where you think there isn't the space-time curvature, space and time are flat, they're ordinary, and gravity is a field on space-time. The textbooks of Richard Feynman and Steven Weinberg, their books on general relativity, take this kind of approach. And I find it intriguing, because if gravity is more like a field, then it's more similar to the other things we have in physics. And you might be able to unify it more easily with the other forces. This is not a cutting edge approach to quantum gravity. And probably people on the cutting edge of quantum gravity might say this is an old idea or this doesn't go so far. But I find it intriguing.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we come back, we'll continue our look at the worlds of physics and philosophy with Caltech Professor Chip Siebens. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's continue now with our conversation on philosophy and physics with Caltech Professor of Philosophy, Chip Siebens. Let's dive into some of the weird things about quantum mechanics, and maybe you can kind of help explain some of these things that, you know, people have heard of, but maybe don't quite understand. So let's start with somebody that wrote a book about philosophy and physics, Werner Heisenberg, and the famous uncertainty principle. Can you explain to us, for, you know, a lay audience, what does the uncertainty principle actually say?
In simple terms, the uncertainty principle says, well, it can be applied to different kinds of quantities, but if you apply it to position and momentum, it says that the more you know the position of a body, the more certain you can be of the body's position, the less certain you are of its momentum, and vice versa. So maybe it helps to back up a little bit here. You know, we're talking about the difference between classical physics and quantum physics a bit. And in classical physics, you have bodies that have definite locations in space. They're at particular places. They move with particular speeds, velocities. They move along certain paths through space. Things are pretty straightforward. You might model it as an extended body with some size, or for simplicity, you might model it as a point body. So you might say you have a point-sized body following a particular path through space. That's what you'd expect classically. In quantum physics, the way that you represent bodies is totally different. Instead of just having a point move through space, the usual thing to do is to describe a body by a wave function. So instead of just having it at a certain location, it is in somehow in many places at once, or, you know, the wave function assigns a certain number to each point in space. And if you square that, you get a probability of finding the particle in different places. So that's inherently a very different kind of description of the body. Instead of it, you know, just being at a certain place, it's now got this kind of spread out quantum state. And the Heisenberg uncertainty principle tells you about the spread of that quantum state. And it says that if it's very tightly peaked in position, if the particle is essentially in a small region, then we're not really so sure where it's going. And if we know very well where it's going, we know its momentum very well, then it's pretty spread out in position. It's not really tightly localized at a particular place.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And I remember as a kid growing up in the atomic age, in the 1950s and 60s, you had this picture that I did as a child of an atom having a nucleus of protons and neutrons in the center, and it's being orbited by electrons. And in my head, you know, it's like, oh, that's like a solar system. But it's not like that really at all. Whereas, you know, I can tell you exactly where Earth or Jupiter will be 20 years from now, 200 years from now. I can tell you exactly what point in space it'll be at. Where it'll be in the sky. We've been able to do that for a very long time, but you can't do that with an electron, can you?
Yeah, that's right. And I think it's important to try to update that picture that you have. So I think many of us kind of first learn about atoms that way. We think, okay, there's a nucleus in the middle and then electrons orbiting the nucleus, but that's not the contemporary model in physics. Not what you see in a more accurate model of the atom is some kind of electron cloud, right? So you have a nucleus in the middle, and then there's this, you know, fuzzy cloud around it that represents something about the electron or the electrons in the atom. But what exactly does that cloud represent? What does it mean? I mean, mathematically, the cloud that you see depicted around the nucleus, it's the square of the wave function of the electron. But what is that telling us? Erwin Schrödinger, when he first put forward the idea of using wave functions to describe particles, and he put forward the central wave equation of quantum mechanics, the Schrödinger equation, he said that the square of the wave function gives you the density of charge. So if you're wondering where is the electron's charge in the atom, he says, oh, it's spread out throughout this cloud. So you have this diffuse cloud of electron charge with the nucleus as this tight collection of charge in the middle of the atom. That was the picture that Schrödinger initially had. But pretty soon after Schrödinger put that picture forward, Max Born came back with a different interpretation of the square of the wave function, a different idea of what that's telling you. Born said that it doesn't give the distribution of charge, where the charge is. It gives you probability of finding the electron in different places. So then you look at that cloudy picture of the atom and you think, okay, we don't know where the electron is exactly, but when you look, this cloud gives you the chance of finding it different places. But then you wonder what's happening before you're looking, like what's going on in the atom before that. And there are a variety of different options that are still potentially on the table or that people debate and try to figure out. So one thing that's fascinating to me is like we don't really know what's happening inside the atom. We don't really know where the electron is or where the electron's charge is. There are models according to which there's a point electron in that cloud somewhere moving in some particular way within the cloud. That's one kind of approach that people have pursued, and there are variants of that. On some of those views, the electron moves around so rapidly that you might think the cloud is a sort of long exposure photograph of the electron. It shows how the electron zips around. There are other ways that you might have a point electron in there that moves differently. Or you might say that the electron is diffuse. It's spread out. You have this charge distribution throughout the atom. I like that kind of view better personally. I like the idea that the electron is actually spread out throughout that electron cloud.
I'm glad you mentioned Schrödinger, because it was just recently I was talking to some friends and listening to them, you know, telling a joke about, well, this thing could be this or it could be that. And then it dawned on me, oh, you're talking about Schrödinger's cat. And they did. And they laughed, said, yep, that's what we're talking about, even though they really didn't understand what Schrödinger's cat's all about. Can you tell us about Schrödinger's cat? Because it's such a famous thought experiment, and it's so cool, and it's fascinating, and it does you know, kind of convey these strange ideas about quantum mechanics and the model of the atom.
Yeah. So Einstein had written a paper on quantum mechanics and the strangenesses of quantum mechanics with a couple of colleagues, Podolsky and Rosen. And in discussing that EPR, famous EPR paper with Einstein, Schrödinger ended up coming to this thought experiment to illustrate the strangeness of quantum mechanics in the way that it's normally presented and understood. So the thought experiment with the cat, is to imagine that you have a sealed box, so you can't see what's going on inside it. Inside the box is a cat, but there's also a quantum experiment going on inside the box. You can vary exactly what that quantum experiment is, but some kind of quantum experiment that has a chance of killing the cat and a chance of leaving the cat alive. So maybe a bottle of poison that might be broken or not broken, depending on a certain measurement of a quantum particle, such as seeing when a radioactive atom decays or something like that. So you have then, according to a standard way of understanding quantum mechanics, a cat that is in a superposition of being alive and dead, that is in some ways both alive and dead until you look. Because on this standard approaches to quantum mechanics, Schrodinger's equation is the equation that you use until someone makes an observation, until you look. And then you use a different rule, sometimes called the collapse postulate. And that rule is the thing that gets you a particular outcome for your experiment. The Schrodinger equation would get you all of the outcomes. It doesn't select a particular one. And it's this collapse rule that gets you a particular outcome. So if that collapse rule is truly only to be applied when a human makes a measurement, like when you open the box, then this cat is both alive and dead until you look in the box. And that's super strange. Schrodinger thought that was absurd. There are other moves you could then make. Maybe you think the cat itself is capable of making a measurement and collapsing the wave function. So maybe the wave function collapses earlier. But what if you were to repeat the experiment with a less advanced life form? Would it be capable of making a measurement? It leads to all sorts of questions. Philosophers of physics tend to not like approaches to quantum mechanics that give a special role to the observer in this way, where fundamentally what's happening in nature depends on whether you're looking or not, depends on whether an observation is being made. That's very strange.
That's kind of a bit like the, you know, if a tree falls in the forest and nobody's there to hear it, does it make a sound argument?
Yeah. So I think it's very weird to have laws of physics where it matters whether an observer is looking or not, whether a measurement is being made. I was talking about some of those beautiful laws of classical physics before, like F equals MA, like Maxwell's equations of electromagnetism. Those laws are laws that apply whether or not anyone's looking. It doesn't matter whether you have an observer or whether a measurement's being made. Those are just general laws of nature. And you'd like to find the same kinds of things for quantum mechanics if you could, so that you could formulate the theory without requiring this collapse upon observation. And there are a variety of competing ways to do so. And I find those very exciting. But they all have responses to the Schrodinger cat problem. The Schrodinger cat problem is, you know, particularly bad for this idea that collapses just happen upon human measurement.
Yeah, it's interesting because you wouldn't think that the act of observing something would affect the something. But
no, and I don't want it to. I'd like to find a version of quantum physics that doesn't have that strange property.
That sounds like a philosopher right there. That's very, very philosophical. I like that, Chip. There's this interesting idea in quantum physics now about entanglement that, for example, I don't know, this is something you're interested in, electron spin, that two electrons in completely different locations can somehow have this quantum communication with each other that, you know, if the spin changes on one, the spin will change on the other. Could you give us just a sense of what the entanglement problem is all about? Why it's important?
Yeah, entanglement is a very central feature of quantum physics. And it's something that you have to understand quantum physics well. And any attempt to make sense of quantum mechanics, the weirdness of quantum mechanics, will have to have some account of what's going on with quantum entanglement. You can have the spins of quantum particles entangled. So in some ways, quantum particles like electrons, they act like they're spinning. Physicists tend not to say that they truly spin. They say something like they have a property called spin. There's a lot to say about this. You can get into the ways in which they act like they're spinning. But for now, let me just say, you know, you can spin along different axes. You can spin in different ways, in different directions. The way in which a top spins is different from the way in which a yo-yo spins. Right, they're sort of spinning about different axes. So with a quantum particle like an electron, you might try to figure out what axis it is spinning around, or it is acting like it's spinning around if it's not truly spinning. And you can do this through various quantum experiments. Famous one is the Stern-Gerlach experiment. So if you send your quantum particle through a certain kind of magnetic field, an inhomogeneous magnetic field, then it might be deflected in one direction if it's spinning a certain way, and deflected in a different direction if it's spinning a different way. And then you can see where it ends up, see where it's been deflected to figure out its spin. Now, interestingly, if you set up the right kind of quantum experiment where two particles with spin are created from a particle without spin, that's one way of doing it, then the spins of those particles that you've created must be oppositely aligned, because there's a principle of conservation of angular momentum. So if you started out with no angular momentum, then what you get at the end must have in total no angular momentum. So if there is some
angular
momentum,
one's got to be spinning one way and the other the opposite way, however that spin is.
Exactly. But interestingly, in quantum physics, it's not that we can just say, okay, on this run of the experiment, this one was up, that one was down, and on this run, that one was down, and this one was up. And it's sort of predetermined initially what each one's spin is. Each one is in a superposition of spinning all sorts of different ways. But what we can say for sure is that their spins are opposite. And so if you measure one far away and you measure the other one far away, you're always going to get opposite spins for each one, even though before you took those measurements, there didn't seem to be a pre-existing value for the spin of each. Each one was initially in this kind of quantum superposition of different spins.
Yeah, it's like somehow they're communicating with each other over these distances, and it's like hard to understand how that could happen.
Yeah. So they might be doing that, and that's a kind of non-locality. And some versions of quantum physics, some interpretations of quantum mechanics embrace that or allow that and say, yeah, they're really interacting in this faster-than-light distant kind of way. And the other kinds of approaches try to somehow preserve locality and say, no, there's a connection here, but it's not, there's no faster-than-light interaction happening. And then that's a different kind of approach.
Yeah, because as we, in one sense, we know that that's not possible, but that's one of the really fun things about quantum mechanics. I would just, from your point of view as a philosopher, there's just so many interesting, strange aspects to quantum mechanics. It's hard to convey to somebody who hasn't studied it at all. Is that a real challenge for you as a teacher when you're, talking to students, people that maybe not your students that are interested in your work?
Yeah, there certainly are a ton of strange aspects to be communicated. And to me, that's what's so enticing and wonderful about studying quantum physics is, there are all these mysteries and weird things that, to me, I want to demystify. I want to make better sense of this. I want to have a more coherent, nice version of quantum mechanics where it's not so mysterious what's happening, where there are precise ideas as to what's happening. And so when I teach my class on the philosophy of quantum mechanics, I give them like six options of, here are a bunch of different proposals as to what's really going on in quantum mechanics. And each one has some strange aspects, but each, at least there's an attempt with each to get at a clear picture of nature. So with quantum mechanics, you have a kind of pushing the bump under the rug of the weirdness. Maybe you've got some weirdness over here. Maybe you have some weirdness over there. There's ways to eliminate this weirdness, but then you have to accept that weirdness. So many different ways you can go to try to clean up the theory.
After a short break, we'll be back for more as Caltech Professor of Philosophy Chip Siebens and I discuss modern physics and how philosophy can perhaps be used to unlock the secrets of the universe on scales from the smallest subatomic particles to the vast realm of our universe of galaxies. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's continue now as we examine the strange worlds of quantum physics with Caltech Professor of Philosophy, Chip Siebens. And you are very interested, as I mentioned before, in this notion of spin. Like, I know, like, for if you've taken high school chemistry, You know, you've done electron configuration diagrams, and you put the spin of the electrons in the diagram, you know, up, down, to, you know, account for all your electrons. And I remember a student asking me, what does this actually, these arrows mean up and down? And I just looked at them and said, if you go to Caltech someday, I remember saying this, and study quantum mechanics, you'll understand why that question's a really good one. Can you talk a bit about your take on electron spin?
Yeah. This is something I've been thinking about a lot. And maybe like your students, I found it frustrating the way it was initially taught. I thought, well, it's really weird that, you know, electrons have this property called spin, but we're not supposed to think of them as actually rotating, or it's unclear how they could be actually rotating. That was super strange to me. So it was always something weird that I held on to in my back pocket as, you know, something that I'd like to figure out or understand better. And as I studied more, I started to come to ideas about how to maybe make better sense of that and understand electrons as truly spinning. So that's the approach I like now. Maybe I can say a little bit about why it's hard to understand the electron is spinning, or why some people think that the electron can't really be spinning. The clues that the electron is spinning, and the reason why we say that the electron has spin, is because the electron has angular momentum, like a spinning top. That's one clue that electrons seem to be spinning. Also, electrons act like little magnets. And if you take a spinning charged body, like if you took a spinning top and that top had positive charge or it had negative charge, a spinning charged body gives rise to magnetic field, acts like a little magnet. This is kind of like what's happening in an electromagnet or a solenoid. You have charge going around loops, and then that gives rise to a magnetic field. So, you know, the electron is charged. It has negative charge. And it has this behavior that it acts like a little magnet. And the direction of that magnet is aligned with the direction of the electron's angular momentum. So it has angular momentum and it acts like a little magnet. It sure seems like a spinning charged body. And so because of this, you know, physicists in the early days of work on electron spin came up with this idea that the electron seems to be spinning or acting like it's spinning. But some of the first physicists to work on this, Rolf Kronig, George Uhlenbeck, Samuel Goudsmit, they were hesitant to publish, or they published and then they worried about retracting their idea. Maybe they should retract their idea, because other physicists around them were bringing up this problem that the electron can't really be spinning. It's too small. It's so small that in order for its rotation to give rise to that angular momentum and that magnetic strength, it would have to be rotating faster than the speed of light. And that's not possible. Nothing can move faster than the speed of light. Maybe to illustrate that, it helps to think of a classroom physics experiment. So there's a common classroom physics experiment where you stand on a rotating, where you sit on a rotating stool and you hold two dumbbell weights far out and you spin around. You know this one?
And then you pull them in.
Yeah, you pull the weights in. And when you pull the weights in, you spin faster and faster. And it illustrates conservation of angular momentum. When you pull the weights in, you need to spin faster to have the same total angular momentum, but the angular momentum doesn't change, so you're spinning faster. Well, we know what the angular momentum of the electron is, the spin angular momentum. And if the electron is really small, it must be rotating really fast in order to have that angular momentum. And similarly, the charge must be rotating really fast in order for it to have its magnetic strength. And so there's a worry that because we think the electron's really small, it must be rotating faster than the speed of light in order to explain its properties like angular momentum and magnetic strength, but it can't be rotating faster than the speed of light. So it must not really be rotating at all, is the conclusion that some have reached. We shouldn't think of the electron as truly rotating. But I think there's a good response to this, a way to save the idea that the electron is rotating, which is to say that the electron's not so small. It's actually bigger than you might think. And this comes back to what we were discussing before about the atom and where the electron is in the atom. If the electron is some little dot orbiting the nucleus, then yeah, it's really small. But if the electron is that whole electron cloud, if it's that diffuse spread out thing, then it's pretty big, at least, you know, around the size of the atom. So its rotation could give rise to its properties like angular momentum and magnetic strength. And this is then connected to different ways of understanding quantum field theory. So if you understand our best, most advanced quantum theory, quantum field theory, as a theory of electrons as point particles and quantum superpositions of different states, then you can't really understand them as truly spinning. But if you think of quantum field theory as a theory of fields, and there's an electron field, and that field has spread out charge, then the electron can be truly rotating. And that's the picture that I find attractive. And all of this is really about interpreting the equations that we have, not about putting forward new equations or changing them. I think, you know, our quantum theories of spin and our quantum field theory of the electron is great. It works very well. But there's a question of what those equations are telling us about reality. And I think when you look at those equations carefully, they describe a spinning electron.
Fascinating. And it's like a different way of looking at it. You're still using the same information, but just looking at it from a slightly different point of view. I find that interesting.
Yeah. And that's where the role of the philosopher comes in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that's always, and I love you bringing up that high school experiment that's been done so many times in so many classrooms, and you know, and everybody's seen in the Olympics an ice skater where they have their arms out and they're spinning and then they pull their arms in and spin faster and faster.
Yeah, exactly. Like,
how is that possible? You know, just you want to hear the announcer say, "Magnificent demonstration of the conservation of angular momentum. That should win the gold." But they never say that. But you know, it's interesting to think about these things. And something that's always fascinated me, even when I was first studying physics, is the idea of these physical constant numbers. Like for gravitation, there's a number, 6.67 times 10 to the minus 11th newtons, which is force, times meters length, divided by kilograms mass squared. That this number tells you a lot about how the universe works. And there's a bunch of these numbers, these physical constants, Planck's constant, etc. Do you ever think about, like, why is it that these are the numbers? And is there another universe where they're different? You know, it's just that those always have just fascinated me about why those numbers.
Yeah, I've definitely thought about those questions. And it's often marked progress in physics when we're able to get rid of one of those numbers or, you know, realize that we can get by with fewer of those numbers than we had before. So there is a goal in physics in general to try to get the simplest laws of nature we can that have the fewest constants and the least complexity to the shape of the laws. And that's considered to be progress in physics. And I think that's great. We should try to do that. But at the end of the day, are we going to get a physical theory with no constants at all? I don't think so. I think at the end of the day, we're going to find some laws of nature, and they're laws of nature that could have been otherwise in various ways. They're laws of nature that didn't have to be exactly the way they are. They're going to have certain constants in them, certain numbers that you could imagine being different, and they'll also have a certain shape to them. They'll have certain, you know, factors, you know, maybe it's a certain kind of an exponential or a certain kind of a polynomial or whatever shape the laws of nature end up having, that could have been different too. So I think my understanding of it is at the end of the day, we're going to find certain laws of nature, the final theory of physics. It might take a very long time, but hopefully we'll get there. And I don't know if there'll be any explanation for why the laws are those particular laws instead of others, or why the numbers are those numbers instead of others. It's hard to imagine how you ever could have such an explanation. Can you imagine a set of laws that would sort of explain itself, where it wouldn't have any constants or where the constants would be fully explained? I can't really imagine it. So it seems to me like in the end, there will be something unexplained, why these laws instead of others. And this is something we may just have to accept.
There has to be some mystery always left in the universe.
Yeah, you could put it that way.
Yes. Okay, let's go on just a little slightly different fun tact here, a little pop culture. You're a professor at Caltech, and there was a very famous TV show where there were people set as, you know, people that worked at Caltech called The Big Bang Theory on CBS, which is extremely popular. And as sitcoms go, it was fantastic. It was very funny, well-acted, well-written and everything. I'm curious for your colleagues, people at Caltech, what their point of view was seeing that on TV. Was that ever, like, people discuss that and go, oh, well, that's silly? Or, you know, what was your take on that? Because it kind of made you guys, you know, more famous than you already were.
Yeah, it's great to have that kind of image out in the world and to have people getting excited about physics and seeing it as something kind of fun and silly and not always so serious. So I think that's great. I'm not sure what everybody thinks about it at Caltech. But I enjoyed it. I saw a lot of it. I didn't watch every episode, but I saw a lot of it. I thought it was great. And I think the way that they worked in the physics was quite nice. You know, the show wasn't always saying a lot about the physics. There were tons of other storylines there.
It's just kind of the backdrop.
Sometimes in the backdrop. And I think it, you know, made the characters endearing because they have this sort of childlike desire to build things and understand the universe and figure things out. And so it showed that kind of passion, even if it wasn't always showing the physics. But then sometimes it did really get into the physics. Sometimes it, you know, gave these nice bite-sized, fun introductions to really complex topics in physics. So I think that's a great way to get those ideas out into the world and to get people excited about them and curious about them. I think everybody has some curiosity about these big questions about how the universe works. And it's amazing that they hit on such a effective way to deliver some of those insights to the general public.
You know, there's so much we don't understand. And when we look at the big picture of the universe, you know, this the idea that so much of the universe is made of something we don't understand, dark matter and dark energy. Are those things that you explore in your philosophy course?
Not much, but a little bit. So dark matter comes up in my class in one brief way, which is when discussing the idea of falsificationism. So there's a thought that for a theory to be truly scientific, it has to be falsifiable. There have to be some possible experiments that you could conduct in order to rule the theory out, some experiments that would make you throw it out. And when you look at our best theories of gravity, you might say, okay, those theories of gravity, they make very concrete predictions. They tell you how planets will move in the solar system. They tell you they're going to move on elliptical paths. They tell you all sorts of things. Well, when you apply our theories of gravity to the galaxy, you would expect the galaxy to rotate in a particular way. You would expect the far out stars to go around the center at a certain kind of speed. And that doesn't match what you see in experiment. And so that appears to be, on the face of it, a falsification of our theories of gravity. But that's not how it was taken. Our theories of gravity have been so well supported in so many places that the reaction to this has not been to throw out our theories of gravity. The reaction instead has been to posit some unseen mass, some additional matter that is not the ordinary kind of matter, not the stars and planets that we generally take to populate the galaxy. So if you add this additional matter, then you can make sense of the rotation speeds. And so that's one way to save your theory from falsification. And so there's interesting general lessons there about how science should be practiced and whether theories need to be falsifiable and what it takes to falsify a theory. And then as history went, this idea of dark matter turned out to bear a lot of fruit, and there are other experiments that support it. And so what might have initially looked like a somewhat ad hoc move in order to save our theories of gravity turned out to be a wise move. But it's interesting to see that this process of theory testing and falsification is not as cut and dried as you might think.
And then finally, quantum theory is what is, you know, given us this laptop computer and that I'm communicating with you at, and you're using your smartphone. All of those things that we have are based on our understanding of, you know, how atoms work, which is quantum theory. And now, of course, something that was talked about a lot when I was young, artificial intelligence, the HAL 9000 computer from the movie 2001, A Space Odyssey, which came out in 1968. Now artificial intelligence is, you know, part of real life. I'm wondering, you know, just for you, you know, what are your thoughts on, you know, where things are going with all of this technology that we see around us?
I'm not so sure. I'm excited to see where the technology goes, but, you know, people are driven to physics for different reasons. And, you know, for me, the applications are wonderful. They're cool to see, and they have a huge impact, and those are great motivations to do physics. But to me, the main, you know, reason that I've been drawn to physics is just to understand nature, to understand reality, to figure out the basic laws, to figure out what's happening at the smallest scale. So I have a little more of that basic science motivation. And that doesn't mean I'm totally ignorant about the ways in which it's used, but it's not as much what drives me.
Yeah, I'd like the way you put that, because for me, my interest in science is really just my interest in nature. What do you most enjoy about your work, you know, with students there at Caltech? What's the best part of your job? What do you love the most?
There's so many parts of the job that I love. The students, teaching the students, hearing from the students, that part is wonderful. I think being a philosopher of physics, you know, what motivates me a lot is trying to demystify, trying to solve puzzles. And sometimes that's personal. I've just learned something that I didn't learn before. But ideally, you reach something that other people hadn't understood either. And you think that you've made a step forward such that everyone can understand something better than they used to, that you can make this contribution to science, this contribution to philosophy. And so, you know, those are the highs that I'm really striving for, is to demystify, to solve puzzles, to make sense of things.
Well, thanks for helping demystify some of these mystifying concepts to us today on the show. It was really great to talk to you, Chip Stevens, professor of philosophy at California Institute of Technology, Caltech. It was really fun to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Thanks again to our guest, Professor of Philosophy Chip Stevens from the California Institute of Technology in Pasadena. You can learn more about his work at sites.google.com/site/cstevens. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of CAP Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.